Well, good afternoon. We should do introductions around.
I'm Ellie, Wendy, Yoshi, Alice, Karen, Itayo.
So, we have two people coming from far, far away who drove all the way over here this morning from Sacramento and Reno. Yeah. So we are very honored that you join us this way. It's wonderful to see old friends. And keep the connection. So this is our celebration of Rohatsu Sesshin. We always have the opportunity to sit in a number of different places who give a week-long sit, which is the tradition. I remember them well. We used to do them at Hidden Villa on the farm. And we were all young then and extremely ambitious. And Rohatsu Sesshin, Buddha's enlightenment, was just the focus of a lot of ambition, you could say. People would sit very hard, teeth clenched. And when it was the last day, and there was only one more day and night, people would sit up all night just in case enlightenment hit them at the right place just before it was over. So it has so many different layers of meaning. Very, very ancient meaning of simply being a celebration of light, the geophysical way that the earth goes around the sun and how things happen to us in terms of light and life. We especially appreciate that we are alive at this point in the rounding of the seasons, because the light is going away and we feel it. Even though we don't think it particularly, our body is very much affected by our loss of light and therefore of life, the whole energetic of the light begins to fade. And so every people who go through this have some sort of way of enhancing the light, enhancing appreciation for life itself, and for the power of it, you could say. And around it are built many different kinds of appreciation, you could say, whether it's Christmas or Kwanzaa or all the many other ways of celebration. It's about our survival, our connection with our life and death. So, of course, in Buddhism, we have in Zen, we celebrate Buddha's enlightenment at this time of year. Other Buddhists celebrate it usually in May, and it's all one big celebration, birth and death and enlightenment and the whole thing. But we sparse it out across the year so that we have just the enlightenment at this time of year, at just the right time of year. So that layer, of course, is very important. Especially if we realize it probably wasn't exactly around this time that Buddha sat under the tree. The interesting thing is that it's a story, but it's a true story. As much as we can know, it is a true story. And already that is encouraging, just on the sensible level. But it's a great deal more than a true story. It begins with someone who didn't really understand the suffering that goes on in life. I have a friend who grew up in Southern California before it was developed. I think he's about my age, maybe a little older, maybe he's 80 now. And he said it was idyllic. It was the happiest childhood, he said, anyone could possibly have. He said he had everything he needed. It was beautiful, beautiful country. And the orange groves, and he could go out into the wilderness. And he just experienced life as perfection. And then when he went to college, he was sent off to college, the blow was so intense for him to realize what life was like for most people. It took him a long time to know what to do with himself about it. He felt so helpless. Here he was in this idyllic kind of way, and nobody else seemed to be feeling like that at all. So he's been sitting zazen ever since. And hard at work in his own way of being with everyone, however they are, we are. So that was Buddha's inspiration, the shock of seeing that his experience was not like everyone else's, and that life in the world is deeply, deeply troubled. So he thought he needed to get to the bottom of it and understand it. And he spent a great deal of time studying with the great teachers of his day, succeeded in, you could say, being enlightened under each teacher. But he told them each time, I'm sorry, this was important, this experience, but when I get up, I don't feel any different. Nothing has changed. So how can I change my way, my view? And they didn't know. So that began his years of trying to separate his life from his life, to bring down or up, depending on which way you're headed, the great powers of life itself, to connect with what they would call, in as a Hindu, Atman, the great being of us, what we would call God, with the notion that we have to work hard in order to create that connection between heaven and earth. And that's what human being is. Many philosophies, Chinese especially, consider that, you know, heaven, earth, and man is a totally natural way, and it's up to man to keep that connection between earth and heaven. So he underwent tremendous amount of suffering, self-imposed suffering, starving himself, letting little boys pee on him, staring at the sun for hours, trying to break the connection with this part in order to connect with that part. And finally, he was so emaciated, so lost, really, that he was right on the edge of life and death. And decided there might be another way. In one story, they say he remembered sitting in his father's garden when he was a child and being overcome with a feeling of just simple happiness, simple contentment, the plain feeling that everything was as it was supposed to be. And he thought in his dying state that maybe instead of doing these things to my mind, trying to wrench my mind into a certain state or another certain state, that I could just sit down and allow things to be the way they are. And as the story says, fortuitously, a young woman came by and she had some yogurt with her and shared it with him, and he began to live again. So in a way, that's the essence of the story. Wish and intention and deliberation to live, to be this life just as it is. That's the very first and most important thing that happened to him. And then, having sat down under a beautiful tree, which is not such a fancy tree, I always like that it's just like the sycamores around here, it's everywhere, that kind of tree. It's a kind of fig tree, but it looks more like a sycamore. It's just an ordinary, everyday tree. And he sat down under an everyday tree with his mind and his body, with nothing extra. And to his surprise, he discovered that his mind was full. It was full of junk, full of crap, full of what is called Mara. It's so nice to personalize it. Think of Mara as a person. Very difficult. And yet somehow it's our mind. So as he sat there, he began to think about how he was the son of a king, after all. And Mara told him, you know, you're the son of a king. You could be a king, too. You could own the world. You could tell everybody what to do. You could have all the money you want. I'll give it to you. You just get off your seat here and get on with your life. Don't mess around with this whole stuff you've been doing all along. Don't waste your time. And then Buddha would realize that he could see that this was happening in his mind. And he said, I see you, Mara. I just see what you're doing to me. And then it would go. Once it's seen, then it has no power. So Mara offered him boundless sex, all the money he could want, all the power, and finally was so exasperated he called in his army and tried to kill him off. Don't quite know how that works in the mind, but there's probably something that in his view that was being oppressed in some way that we experience in our sitting. All these things, all this stuff that comes up for us. And again, he said, I see you, Mara. It's very quiet out there where he was. There's a little river running through. A little village across the river. And I think as he spent his time dealing with Mara, he freed his mind enough to begin to see deeply where he came from. And that's one of the things that is told, that he saw all the way back to the very beginning of life, to the very first little bacteria, or first amoeba, or whatever smaller than that. How life engendered more life and built life upon life upon life and became more and more complex, and that he was a part of that, going back into the past so far back you couldn't even tell how far back. And he began to feel the animal nature of himself, that human nature encompassed all the other kinds of nature that are here, that we are that, this. He felt it all the way. And then he watched how his mind was working in terms of wanting. Just eager to grab onto any idea, any possibility of getting something, of being something. All the grabby kinds of ways that our mind is working in order to create a self. He watched himself create himself. I'm this kind of person, and I know this kind of thing, and I'll never do this, but I really will always do that, and on. And finally he said, it's like building a house. He said, there's something in me that's building a self all the time. He said, I see you, house builder. I see you building the roof beam building the floor. You don't have to build anymore, you said to the roof builder, to the house builder. You don't have to do that. But there was some disturbance about what he was doing. There was some, whether it was doubt or regret or something that said he didn't quite have the right to be doing what he was doing. They say it was one of the gods, somebody up there. Said he had no right. He probably felt that about himself. And rightfully so. Of course, we feel so humble as we begin to see clearly how things are. And the feeling that he had no right gave him a chance to realize that he did have a right. That he himself was it, just as each of us is it. There isn't any other one but this one. And you've seen many, many descriptions and statues and drawings of how he touched the ground. The very ground, not the ground of being or anything like that, just the dirt that we are and where we came from. And he said, "The earth is my witness. I do have a right." And then the Mahayana story goes on to say, he looked up and saw what probably was Venus at this time of year, some time of year, a beautiful planet. Gleaming and saw it in the way that we see when we're not attending to ourselves anymore. He saw it as all beings, he said, are enlightened with me. So on some of the old stories, they say there was an earthquake and there was a rainbow and marvelous things happened. But the marvelous thing that happened was that we know this story now. And the truth of the story lives for us and in us. There's no have to or should be in the story. There's no pressure from anywhere to say you must believe. This story just points to the place under the tree where anyone can sit down. Any place, in any condition. That's the best part. Don't have to be smart. Don't have to be beautiful. You don't have to be old and wise. You don't have to be etc. can go and touch the earth and have the right to be there, to be here, to be with all things. Being with all things doesn't mean that we have to love everybody in the singing violins kind of way, but it means that we appreciate all in each condition, whatever that condition is. Know it through this self of us, which takes in and then expresses with every encounter. Buddha freed himself from his practice, so-called, in order to be with everyone, and spent many, many years after that walking through the heat of those dusty roads and meeting with everyone, rich people, poor people, good students, quarreling students. Lots of great stories about Buddha's life. But his life was simply an exemplification of every possibility of our life. Which is why it's endured. The truth of it has endured. So when we sit, we don't have to sit in order to get something, because we never will. We sit as Buddha sat, giving up the wish to get something and simply allowing the mind to be the way it you were born to be, and the preciousness of our brilliance, you could say, the light of us, to let it shine. So that's what I brought to say. Questions? Additions? Subtractions?
When I don't feel I have light to let it shine, what should I do?
If you don't feel you have light, you probably never, we don't feel it. We feel it best when we're not thinking about ourselves and trying to help somebody else, or when we're deeply involved with something and not thinking about ourselves. When we're just living our life without worrying about ourselves, that's when the light shines. It shines in activity, in action.
In action.
In action. Even small things, even lifting little things. Mm-hmm.
sometimes I get scared, and when I've meditated for a while, and then I don't understand the fear exactly, but I notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has to do with the emptiness, the experience of emptiness.
The best way is just to stay present and not get out there. Going out there is one state of mind, but that it's not even emptiness. Emptiness means being completely connected with everything. It doesn't mean empty. So there is a state, and the Quakers warn about that, and a lot of teachers do, that you don't want to go out into some kind of spacey place, because that's not you. The most best place is just to be with you, your heart and breath, in place, in the place where it is. And don't try to get lost out there. And if you feel like that, you can come back. Just bring yourself back. And if it's too uncomfortable, get up and take a walk. And just remember, there's only one Karen in the whole world, and that's you. And that you're fine.
With the idea that everything, that Mara, maybe I misunderstood what she said at the beginning, that Mara is the working of our mind.
Oh, yeah.
It's just all Mara. All of that.
Yeah.
All everything that our mind churns up.
What else would do it?
I guess I think of Mara as having sort of a negative connotation of sort of a temper or a bit. Yeah, everything in our mind so is bad. I mean, it's kind of like if Mara is bad, everything in our mind turns up as bad.
Well, it doesn't say everything. It says about 50%.
What's the other 50%?
The good.
But then are we into that black and white?
We have a choice every time. Every single time. Only if we're aware and awake and knowing our situation, the black and the white, and then the good and the bad, so-called.
I see.
Then we're given a choice. And Buddha said, second noble truth, choose the good.
Okay.
Sounds very simple, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. But that's the way it is. And in the stories about Mara, Mara stays with Buddha his whole life, all the way up until his death day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one, my favorite story is when Buddha is taking a nap and somebody comes to the door and Ananda greets Mara at the door. And he says, Mara, go away. The Buddha's sleeping and he doesn't want to see you. And Buddha says, who's there, Ananda? He says, oh, it's just Mara. I'm sending him away. And Buddha says, oh, no, my old friend Mara. Bring him in and we'll have a cup of tea. That's often the best way of dealing with Mara.
Mm-hmm.
Is not trying to smash the bad in us. That just creates more bad. It creates a complication on top of complication. Better to acknowledge and accept and appreciate and go on as best we can with the best that we can find in ourselves. And trust that there's at least 50% good in there. That's really important.
Okay. Well, Mara, as I recall you saying, also tried to tell Buddha that it was way past time for him to die.
Yes.
And he bargained with Mara. Right?
Yes.
So maybe that's a strategy, too.
Right, bargain with me.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes I think when I'm being fussed or in my mind or being offered something, I know it's, I just say thank you very much, Mara. I just appreciate, but now, goodbye.
Yeah, okay. Just like somebody who comes to the door that you don't have to let them in.
Yes.
Different than an
ego trip? Well, that's another way of talking about it. Yeah. Yeah, it's really all made up in our head. It's just one more way of grandiosity, you could say, the great me. We have more sitting to do, so maybe we should do that. And at the end, we have a baby. So. One of our long-standing members has moved away and had a baby that we haven't seen yet, and she's bringing her over this afternoon at 4 when we're finished. So that we can go goo goo gaga for this cute little baby. Yeah. So thank you all.